This is a CBC podcast.
Your heart shatters for these people. We have water 4 feet up into their first floor here. Their church is gone. Their cars are gone. This is a neighborhood that doesn't have a lot. And the very little they had, they've lost everything.
The storm that hit Florida with so much leaves some communities with nothing. As Milton moves offshore, its deadly path of destruction is becoming clear. Homes, businesses, and infrastructure ripped apart. Entire neighborhoods swallowed by flooding. As rescue operations seek out stranded residents, millions are still without power, and many lost much more than that. Welcome to Your World Tonight. I'm Susan Bonner. It is Thursday, October 10th, coming up on 6 p.m. Eastern, also on the podcast.
TD Bank created an environment that allowed financial crime to flourish. By making its services convenient for criminals, it became one.
The largest ever penalty of its kind, handed down by American regulators, and it's on a Canadian bank. TD agrees to pay billions and have its growth restricted in the U.S. after admitting the bank knew criminals were using it to launder money and nobody stopped it. Parts of Florida are still under emergency orders tonight, and search and rescue efforts are ongoing after Hurricane Milton tore through the state with devastating winds and catastrophic flooding, killing at least 10 people and leaving many communities once again picking up the pieces less than 2 weeks after another destructive hurricane. The CBC's Katie Simpson begins our coverage tonight from one of the hardest hit communities on Florida's Gulf Coast.
The rescue efforts are urgent and chaotic. In Tampa, a police officer helps a crying boy into his cruiser after his home was struck by a tree.
It's okay, Bubba. It's okay. It's okay. You're okay.
In the same community, officers in a boat save a teenage boy in shoulder-deep floodwaters who'd been clinging to a fence. While residents of an assisted living home take refuge in the street, relieved they were plucked from their residence after it flooded as they slept.
It was coming up in my bed, to the edge of my bed. I mean, it got on, it was terrible.
And that sounds terrifying.
The water was so cold.
Getting people to safety and restoring power are the priorities right now for Florida Governor Ron DeSantis.
The storm was significant, but thankfully this was not the worst case scenario. The storm.
Hurricane Milton made landfall as a Category 3 storm near Siesta Key in Sarasota, not Tampa Bay as many had feared. Wind gusts close to 200 kilometers per hour knocked over trees and took out power for millions, ripping the roof from Tropicana Stadium, home to the Tampa Bay Rays baseball team, and what was supposed to be a first responders staging center. And while storm surge peaked around 3 meters, causing flooding in coastal communities, it was not as bad as expected.
It was loud. The power went out early, I'd say about 6:30, you know, blue flashes everywhere. And the wind started blowing, I think.
Sheila Haskell lives in the city of Palmetto. It's about 30 minutes north of Sarasota. There's debris all over her lawn, and she lost some roof tiles. Nothing compared to what she saw nearly 2 weeks ago when Hurricane Helene hit.
What on earth is it like to have two massive hurricanes back to back?
Emotionally draining. So we had
driving around her neighborhood, you see substantial damage. Snapped trees rest on power lines. Stop signs have been ripped out of the ground. Chunks of people's houses are missing. What you also notice, so many homes are boarded up. They were badly damaged by Helene, and what's left took a second significant blow.
Well, I've lived here my whole life, so we've dealt with it, but nothing like this.
Stephanie Sheffield wipes away tears as she looks down her street. While her home has minor damage, her neighbors may have to rebuild.
Just tell me in this moment how you feel.
I don't know. It's just really hard watching everybody go through it. They're all super good people and don't deserve it. Not that it could be helped, but, you know.
Sheffield takes some comfort in the sense of community here. Neighbors work together to clear debris. They share food and supplies as they brace for what will be a long and painful rebuilding process. Katie Simpson, CBC News, Palmetto, Florida.
Milton's devastation wasn't limited to Florida's Gulf Coast. The storm spawned dozens of tornadoes, the worst of them hitting a community on the Atlantic side of the state where most of the deaths occurred. Vanessa Lee has more on that.
And you can feel that tornado coming through, and we just watched everything get picked up.
It was well ahead of landfall when Hurricane Milton shocked the state with deadly tornadoes. At least 38 twisters ripped through more than a dozen counties, including St. Lucie County north of Palm Beach, an area not under evacuation orders. Homes have been reduced to rubble. Keith Pearson is the local sheriff.
These tornadoes came out of nowhere. Our deputies reported back. I heard for myself, I was out there with them. Six different tornadoes touched down in a matter of 20 minutes.
Milton was already in the history books as the Gulf's strongest late season storm. And according to preliminary estimates, analysts say it could be one of the most expensive. Nadja Dreff is with credit ratings agency Morningstar DBRS.
We do believe substantial insured damage. In our view, that insured loss could approach $60 billion, which would make it close to one of the largest catastrophes in the recent past.
Experts say with two back-to-back devastating storms hitting Florida, home insurance costs are almost certain to skyrocket if owners are able to get it at all. Michael Mann is with the University of Pennsylvania.
If you can't insure a home in a region, you're not going to want to live there. And we're seeing the same thing now on our coast.
This afternoon, U.S. President Joe Biden says the federal government will provide all of the resources required to rescue, recover, and rebuild, but added this warning.
Anyone who seeks to take advantage of our fellow Americans' desperation, whether you're a company engaging in price gouging or a citizen trying to scam your neighbors, we will go after you and we will hold you accountable.
Across Florida, more than 3 million homes and businesses lost power. 50,000 line workers have come together from around the world, including Canada, to help with restoration efforts. Newfoundland's Tony Anderson is among them.
For me, it's important because, as I said, we're helping people try to get the power back to their own so they can get back to their normal life.
It's unclear how long it will take for Florida to get back to normal. Right now, some airports remain shut down. Roads are impassable, and conditions are still dangerous. Officials are urging people to stay home. Craig Fugate is a former emergency management administrator.
When they get out and they start driving or moving around, they fall into or drive into areas that are flooded, not realizing how deep it is.
Long-term recovery efforts could be hindered by the threat of even more severe weather. There are still more than 7 weeks left in this hurricane season. Vanessa Lee, CBC News, Montreal.
Coming up on the podcast, TD fined billions of dollars for criminal activity in the U.S. and number crunching the carbon tax effect on Canadians. Plus, game, set, match for one of sport's biggest stars. U.S. authorities have slapped TD Bank with a historic $3 billion fine. In a major investigation, the company pled guilty to multiple charges, including conspiracy to commit money laundering. Our business reporter Nisha Patel is tracking this story for us. Nisha, TD being called, in effect, a criminal organization today. Remind us of the backstory.
Susan, for months, TD Bank has been under investigation in the U.S., where it has widespread operations. Officials there alleged drug traffickers had been bribing TD Bank tellers to launder as much as $670 million from selling fentanyl. TD has pleaded guilty to this and will pay a stunning $3 billion. That's the largest fine of its kind ever. Here's U.S. Attorney General Merrick Garland.
At various times, high-level executives, including the person who became the bank's chief anti-money laundering officer, knew there were serious problems with the bank's anti-money laundering program. But the bank failed to correct them. TD Bank created an environment that allowed financial crime to flourish. By making its services convenient for criminals, it became one.
Garland also said criminal investigations into individual TD employees are ongoing and that no one is off limits.
And what are we hearing from TD?
The bank had a conference call this afternoon to reassure investors. CEO Bharath Masrani said TD is taking responsibility and is cooperating with regulators.
This is a sad day in our history for which, you know, we are very regretful and apologetic to all of our stakeholders because this is a terrible event for TD, but we know what we have to do to go forward. And this was a failure of our U.S. program, and we are fixing it, and I'm 100% confident that we get to the other side and emerge even stronger.
Masrani is shouldering the blame for this scandal and has announced that he will retire. His successor, Raymond Chun, will take over in April, and he will have to prove that he'll really shake up how the bank is managed and how it plans to beef up its anti-money laundering program.
What's the ultimate effect on the company?
Susan, this is a serious fine and a stain on TD's reputation, and it will hit the bank's profitability. This isn't going to bankrupt the business, but the biggest impact could be the non-monetary penalties. The U.S. regulator put in place a cap on the bank's assets, as well as restrictions on opening new branches or launching new products in the U.S. That will all severely limit TD's ability to grow its business. TD shares fell 5% on today's news, and this could be a huge drag on the company's stock price for quite some time.
Thank you, Nisha.
You're welcome.
Nisha Patel in Toronto. The Parliamentary Budget Officer reran the numbers for Canada's carbon tax, and the takeaway amounts to a revision of just how much it's affecting Canadians. David Cochrane is host of Power and Politics on CBC News Network. He joins us from Ottawa. David, quite the report. What does it say?
Well, Susan, broadly, the Parliamentary Budget Officer comes to a lot of the same high-level conclusions that we saw in his earlier studies of this, but there are some significant changes that we should talk about. But on a broad level, it is still, you look at a simple fiscal impact, how much you pay in carbon tax and how much you get back in rebate, the vast majority of Canadians are better off. When he does the broader economic analysis, which includes the carbon tax, the rebate, but just the ripple effect throughout the economy of all the higher costs, Yves Giroux concludes that there will be a dampening effect on the economy and most households in Canada will be worse off. But the order of magnitude has completely changed because he made a big error in his old analysis that he included the economic consequences of the industrial carbon price in his math. So what the big polluters and big emitters pay was lumped in there and blamed on the consumer carbon tax, which is not the case. That's now been pulled out. It's still an overall net negative by 2030, but the numbers are much, much smaller.
Well, take us through a couple of examples. How does it compare to the earlier projections?
Yeah, there's all kinds of breakdowns by economic levels. But just to give you some high level numbers, Alberta, for example, the old report said the average household would lose about $2,800 a year by 2030 in income and economic costs. That's now revised down to just under 700. Saskatchewan has gone from 1,700 net loss to just under 900. So the orders of magnitude at $170 a ton of carbon price is cut in half. That's a big change. It's still a negative, but it is nowhere near sort of these high levels that we saw before. And the other change that comes out of this new analysis is that the bottom 40% of Canadian households, the most economically vulnerable, the seniors, the low-income earners, by 2030, even with this economic hit from the carbon tax, even with the carbon price going up to $170 a ton, they are still better off. That's a completely different assessment than we've seen in past reports.
So do you have a line or two on how this might impact the debate over the carbon tax going forward?
Probably will have no effect. The Conservatives are very dug in. Axe attacks is a central point of their election pitch. The Liberals are digging in saying this shows that what they have been saying all along is correct and point to the limitations of this report. Because even though it's a revised set of numbers, there are still limitations. The Parliamentary Budget Officer doesn't look at the cost of climate change, doesn't look at the economic benefits of the transition. Those numbers aren't in there, only the cost side of the cost-benefit analysis.
Good to have you on the program, David. Thank you.
Thank you.
The CBC's David Cochrane in our Parliamentary Bureau. As temperatures drop, the danger rises for people trying to illegally cross the U.S.-Canada border. American Border Patrol officers are warning people of the risks, risks that may be enhanced with the outcome of the contentious U.S. election. Karen Pulse reports.
All right, so this is one of our surveillance vehicles.
Border Patrol officers are showing off some of the ways they catch people illegally walking across the Canada-U.S. border, like this scope truck, which has a big mast with a periscope and thermal camera on it.
Anything thermal, anything warm that's out here, is they really show up. So
and first aid if someone gets into trouble and needs rescuing.
See frostbite and hypothermia.
Scott Garrett is the chief patrol agent responsible for the Manitoba-North Dakota border on the U.S. side. He has this message for those contemplating the journey.
Do not put your life and the lives of your family in the hands of a dishonest smuggler, one who promises to deliver you safely and securely, only to abandon you on the doorstep of danger.
In 2022, a family from India froze to death walking across a farmer's field from Manitoba into the U.S. In another high-profile case in 2016, two men lost their fingers and almost their lives walking into Canada. Illegal crossing spiked in 2018 when then-President Donald Trump said he would deport undocumented migrants, rhetoric that has returned with next month's U.S. presidential election. Trump and Kamala Harris are both talking about cracking down on border security.
We're going to have the largest deportation in the history of our country. We have no choice.
Someone does not make an asylum request at a legal point of entry and instead crosses our border unlawfully, they will be barred from receiving asylum.
Donald Abelson is a political science professor at Western University in London, Ontario.
And we've heard a lot of rhetoric about what Trump intends to do if he is elected to office for the second time. He has talked about getting very rough with illegal migrants. The language is toxic, it is polarizing, but I suspect he means what he says. Harris has waffled a bit, but I suspect she will do her very best to protect the border as well.
Mara Moravielpando is watching this all closely. She's an advisor to La Resistencia, a grassroots organization that works with detained migrants in Washington state. She knows people planning to move to Canada, fearing deportation to their country of origin if Trump is reelected.
Now people are being forced to having to take the worst conditions ever to thinking they're going to be safe. Sadly, we will see people dying in the Canadian border.
Back at the border, U.S. Patrol Agent Garrett wants to focus on the job at hand, not politics.
The candidates have different plans, and we'll work with what plans that they give us. But that doesn't change our mission. Prevent people from entering the country in either direction illegally, and to enforce the laws that are on the books as they are.
Or whatever they might be after November the 5th. Karen Pauls, CBC News, Winnipeg.
At least 27 people are dead after an Israeli airstrike on a school in central Gaza, according to Gaza health officials. It was sheltering displaced people. The Israeli military says it targeted militants. But people there say the strike hit a meeting of aid workers. In Lebanon, the United Nations is responding to its headquarters being hit by Israeli tank fire.
These are very well-known positions.
Andrea Tenente is with the United Nations Interim Force in Lebanon. Two peacekeepers were wounded in the attack.
The UN headquarters, UNIFIL headquarters in Nahura, is a huge base. It's the headquarters where the force commander, head of mission, is located. The other position is close to the tripartite area where we used to have meetings between Lebanese army and IDF for 18 years to try to deconflict situations. So it's a very well-known area.
Israel says UN peacekeeping forces in southern Lebanon had been warned to move. The UN says any deliberate attack on peacekeepers is a grave violation of international humanitarian law. And in Beirut, at least 22 people are dead and dozens injured after Israeli airstrikes hit different areas of the capital, according to Lebanon's health ministry. Global Affairs says a Canadian citizen was killed in the country. The conflict in the Middle East has left countless families shattered. Before October 7th last year, women in Gaza with risky pregnancies were given permits to travel back and forth to East Jerusalem for specialized care, but no more. and that's left some infants stranded alone. Chris Brown has one family's story.
The neonatal ward in East Jerusalem's Al-Makassid Hospital is a place of new beginnings. But for some babies born to mothers from Gaza, it's also tragically become where they're growing up without their mothers. Saida is 14 months old. With curly hair and a bright smile, she's mostly healthy now. But for a while, it was touch and go as she needed incubation and surgeries during the first months of her life. Her mother had a high-risk pregnancy. So in July 2023, she was granted a temporary permit to leave Gaza and come to East Jerusalem for treatment. She gave birth to Saida at just 27 weeks.
I told them I have to stay with her. The doctor said that's not possible. She needs to stay 3 months with us.
Our videographer in Gaza met Hebda Idris and her husband in Khan Yunis, who are living in a tent. After the birth, doctors told Hebba to return to Gaza and rest. She was able to go back to Jerusalem to visit Saida in hospital only once before the Hamas attacks of October the 7th.
It's difficult that I'm not there with her to touch her hand, to play with her, change her, bathe her.
Now, the nurses and volunteers in the ward have become her substitute parents, taking turns feeding her, playing with her, and witnessing the milestones of her first year. For safety and security reasons, the staff asked that we not use their names.
Do you think Saida knows her mother?
No, she don't know her mother. She play with everyone. She think everyone is her family. I am happy that I do good thing for them. I care for them. But I am sad for them. I am a mother and I know what the mother feel when her kids is far from her.
The only way Saida has seen her parents is through logistically difficult and infrequent video calls. The Wi-Fi signal often drops out. Her father, Saleh, has never met her in person. Both of them are in tears as they try to hold her attention to form a brief bond, looking at her on the phone screen. Hebba would like for the Israeli agency responsible for permits to let her return to East Jerusalem to be with Saida. Instead, the agency, COGAT, said it would arrange for Saida to come to Gaza, leaving her parents with the awful choice of bringing her into a war zone or remaining separated.
Over there is better for her health-wise. We live in tents, and there's sand, and her immune system is weak.
But the older Saida gets, the harder it will be for hospital staff to keep looking after her, and the harder it will be on her to not have a parent.
And when they need to go to the bathroom and like this, it will be difficult.
Saida's case is sadly not unique. There are four other babies in this ward, including triplets, with parents who are in Gaza, each family desperate for the war to end so they can all be together. Chris Brown, CBC News in East Jerusalem.
Among the greats of men's tennis, few are greater than Rafael Nadal. Tonight, the Spaniard is saying adios to the game he loves. A true global superstar, he was adored by fans and revered by peers. Jamie Strachan has more on Nadal's retirement and the legacy he leaves behind.
For more than two decades, Rafael Nadal has wowed tennis fans around the world with a dizzying blend of shot-making, raw power, and sheer determination.
There's a new man at the head of men's tennis, Rafael Nadal.
The 38-year-old Spaniard will retire at the end of this season as one of the greatest the game has ever seen. It's obviously a difficult decision, one that has taken me some time to make, but in this life, everything has a beginning and an end. Nadal's 23-year career was remarkable. 22 Grand Slams, the second most ever among men. 14 of those at the French Open on the clay of Roland Garros, where he compiled a mind-boggling record of 112-4.
He gave of his all, Nadal. It was wonderful that he came here to compete at all with what he's been through.
He appeared there for the final time last summer, losing in the first round, playing through a debilitating foot injury that's hampered him the last few years.
Yeah, the feelings that I have today are difficult to describe in words, but for me it's so special to feel the love of the people the way that I felt in the place that I love the most.
Nadal is loved across the tennis world, a rare thing. Fellow Spaniard and world number two Carlos Alcaraz called Nadal's retirement a shame.
He has been my idol since I started playing tennis. I look up to him. Probably thanks to him, I really wanted to become professional tennis player.
His greatest rival and longtime friend Roger Federer also weighed in, saying sharing the court with Nadal was an absolute honor.
But it's pretty hard to deny that Djokovic and Federer and Nadal would probably be on your Mount Rushmore.
Longtime international tennis analyst Tom Tebbit had a front row seat to Nadal's dominance.
He would live and die on the court, and you just knew, obviously, you get your money's worth.
Tebbit said it was his unique blend of on-court dominance and off-court class that set him apart.
So, like, he was always modest and totally unpretentious, and everybody liked him just because he was always a gentleman with people, and he would remember everybody, which a lot of the top athletes would never do.
As they say in Spain, we don't say legend, we say Rafa Nadal.
Oh, yes! Sensational stuff, Nadal.
Jamie Strachan, CBC News, Toronto.
Finally, to another foreigner who has a special relationship with Paris, and like Rafael Nadal, she's saying au revoir. A surprise French exit. In the Netflix romantic comedy series Emily in Paris, isn't sitting well with a certain Emmanuel in Paris. French President Emmanuel Macron says he loves the show, it's boosting tourism, and his wife Brigitte even made a cameo.
Bonjour, Madame Macron.
D'accord.
Je suis Emily Cooper.
Emily, c'est vous? Je la suis sur Instagram.
Oui, oui. Oh, yes. J'adore your country.
But despite that adoration and the show's title, season 5 will see American marketing manager Emily Cooper moving to Rome. Her company is opening an office there. And it's also the home of Marcello, the dashing Italian Emily met on a ski trip last season, leaving questions about where things stand with Gabrielle back in Paris. Anyway, Emily's relocation to Rome is a plot twist Macron does not support.
So the show now is moving to Rome. How is that possible? How did you get them back?
Because we will fight hard and we will ask them to remain. Emily in Paris and Roma doesn't make sense.
The president's comments are roiling the political establishment in Italy. Writing on social media, Rome's mayor says Emily is doing great in the city, that Macron should relax and let Emily go wherever her heart takes her. Thank you for joining us. This has been Your World Tonight for Thursday, October 10th. I'm Susan Bonner. Talk to you again.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.